At the end of Matthew 24, we noticed how Jesus, having finished the discussion about the destruction of Jerusalem, turned to his next and final coming. When we look at Matthew 25, we have, towards the end of that chapter, the information about the sheep and the goats. This, of course, refers to Jesus' next and final coming, the separation of the righteous and the unrighteous. Then prior to that information about the sheep and goats, you have some information about the talents. Then prior to that, you have information about the 10 virgins, five wise and 5 foolish. We got through part of the 10 virgins information last week. Let's begin picking up with about verse 5, and then we'll pick up new material, will be verses 10 through 13. In verse 5 it says, "Now when the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. But at midnight there is a cry, 'Behold the bridegroom. Come ye forth to meet him.' Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said unto the wise, 'Give us your oil, for our lamps are going out.' But the wise answered, saying, 'Peradventure there will not be enough for us and you. Go ye rather to them that sell and buy for yourselves.' And while they went away to buy, the bridegroom came. And they that were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward came also the other virgins, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open to us.' But he answered not and said, 'Verily I say unto you, I know you not. Watch therefore, for ye know not the day nor the hour.'" Here's the situation. The bridegroom comes. 5 had been unprepared, so when they're called upon to trim the lamps, we talked about that last week, especially the ladies that light candles, you trim the wick back, you get rid of the old ugly stuff, and it becomes brighter, and you have more light. That was what it was time for in this particular case, but they knew that they didn't have enough oil. In this day and time, depending on the type of lamp, you see, they came out with these a few years ago. Maybe some of you saw them. If you want to wash your windshield, they've got the one end where you scrub your windshield, and on the other end of the stick, there's a place to store the solution. Anybody seen those? That way you've always got your windshield wiper solution in there. That seems to be kind of what we're dealing with here as far as these lamps. There would have been a place in the stick, if you will, to hold some extra oil. And 5 of these did not have that. Well, as you think about the point in verse 9, go buy oil. What time is it?
Midnight.
What do you think the prospect was going to be to find oil around midnight?
Not very good.
I suspect it was not going to be very good for a couple of reasons. Most people, by that time of night, they're thinking, let's go ahead and shut things down. And then Dolores, she's here. I thank her for this. We thought through this a little bit together. I was reminded in our email discussion of Luke 11, verses 5 through 7. You remember back there, Jesus says there's this friend that shows up. And what time does a friend show up wanting some food? He shows up at midnight. And this friend says to his friend, "I want some food." And this guy says, "It's late, it's midnight." Not only does he mention the hour, he also says, "What about his family? My children and I are where?
Sleep.
We're asleep. We're in bed." Well, if Jesus used that teaching to tell us anything about first century culture, it would then seem to me, that would seem to be a very odd illustration if that was not how life generally worked. Well, if that's how most people were living, what would you suspect then about merchants and finding oil at midnight? Well, again, I think the answer that Harvey gave a little bit ago is probably pretty likely, that the chance of finding it was going to be very, very remote. Then you have these kinds of things as well. I can remember a long time ago when I was in school, we had an early morning campaign, and these guys waited on me. But it was one of these deals where we got up at 2 or 3 o'clock because we were going to have a long drive and needed to make it in a single day. And for whatever reason, I overslept. Call came in. "Brad, everybody's here at the school. Where are you?" Well, they were 40 minutes across town. It's a little late if you're not ready to, get on the other side of town. So thankfully they waited. But there are some cases where when it's time to go, it's like the airplane. If they're going to pull out at 9 a.m. and you're not there at 9, good luck. They're not going to wait on you. And that's really what we have here. So they were either prepared or they were not prepared. And in this case, half the group was not prepared. As the unprepared ladies head off to find lamp, the Bible tells us that the bridegroom came. Verse 10 informs us that the 5 wise virgins, they went into the marriage feast. And then Jesus says, after that happened, what occurred? The door was shut. And when it says shut, what impression do you get? People sometimes say, "Well, just shut the door. We don't want to let the bugs in." You think that's what we're dealing with here? No. The door was not only shut, it's locked. It's sealed. It's not going to be opened up again, or it's not going to be opened up to these folks. One fellow, an older commentator, in making some observations on the shut door, he said, "The door shall be shut at last, shut on all pain and sorrow, shut on an ill-natured and wicked world, shut on a tempting devil, shut on all doubts and fears, shut to be opening again no more. Surely we may again say this is a blessed prospect." Well, I like that. Because when you think about this shut door, all the evil people, all evil things, they are going to be completely separated from God's folks. So that's probably not a big part of Jesus' point, but it certainly is consistent with other things that we find in the Bible, and it should be encouraging to us. Anything that you want to add or ask before he says a few more things? Okay. A couple more items here. Do the five foolish virgins eventually return?
Yes,
yes they do. Jesus uses the word afterwards, and whether that turns out to be a few hours, several hours after the feast, whether that's the next day, I can't see anywhere in the English or Greek text to determine exactly how long had passed. But they do show up, and as we look at verse 12, what do we find as far as their ability to enter this gathering? Are they allowed? Are they denied? They're prohibited. Those doors remain closed. And as you look at the text, there should be a passage that springs to mind. How do they make their appeal? Lord, Lord, open the door to us. Well, does that sound a little familiar?
Matthew
7, verse 22. Lord, Lord. And maybe Jesus was thinking back to that teaching. Maybe not, but the comparisons are really striking. And then let's go back there for just a second. Let's look at Matthew. We'll start with verse 21 of Matthew 7 and read down through verse 23, because you can see multiple comparisons, I think, between what we have in that chapter, the Sermon on the Mount, and what we have here in Matthew 25. Beginning in 21, he said, "Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, that's true. We see that in Matthew 25. "But he that doeth the will of my Father who is in heaven." But part of that will is going to be preparation. Matthew 25. "Many will say to me in that day, and here it is, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy by thy name, and by thy name cast out demons, and by thy name do many mighty works?" And then 23 is the other parallel that is really direct to Matthew 25. "And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you." Do you see the parallel between that and Matthew 7:25 and what we have here in Matthew 25? It's in verse 12. "But he answered and said, Verily I say unto you," what? I know you not. There has been a considerable amount of discussion over the years whether or not Jesus is talking about people who have never become Christians, or whether he's talking about people who did become Christians and they fell away. You can argue it a couple of ways if you just look at the English text. For a long time, I favored the idea that he was talking about people who did become God's people, in this case, who would refer to them as Christians because of the time period that we live in, and then fell away. If you wanted to take that position, you could take that position from the standpoint that you have 10 women. They're all part of the group. They all have some oil. They all have lamps. And they're all headed to the same party. But one difficulty with that is when Jesus says, "I know you not," he uses the perfect tense. Anybody remember what's true about the perfect tense? Something was true in the past, and it continues on. So when Jesus says, "I never knew you," that would indicate to me that he's saying about these people, "We never, ever had a relationship." Well, when you look at that, they were still in the group, though. And if this is parallel to Matthew 7, I think this is the point that he's making. You remember those people in Matthew 7? What was their question? "Lord, did we not prophesy in thy name? Did we not cast out demons? And did we not do many mighty works?" So here you have people in Matthew 7. They come off as far as, you know, being the Lord's people. They know his name, Lord, Lord. And they give every indication that they were in a right relationship with God, but they were not. They were never part of the right group because they hadn't obeyed God. Well, as I said, if these two things are parallel, then it would seem to me, rather than primarily be about the people who were not interested in God, these people were interested, but as far as their religious practices, they simply did not know or did not, based on what they knew, choose to follow the Lord in the right way. So could involve non-Christians, but I'm mainly inclined to think here that we have, it is non-Christians, but primarily I'm thinking here the people are those who are not involved with the right faith. Anything you want to add or ask before we pick up another quick point and then verses 14 and 15? Dolores? Right, and that's the idea. Yes, that's the idea. When you look at that word know, it has the sense in this verse of association, affiliation, and it's the same point that you find back there in Matthew 7. We were never connected. So, and that's why I say it doesn't seem to be so much a fallen away Christian. The Bible does recognize that. People who fall away and they don't come back, they're going to be lost. But in this particular case, they were people with spiritual inclinations. They did not do what God required, Matthew 7, verse 21. Thus, even though it may have appeared from the external things they were God's people, they were not. But yes, that is an excellent point to bring up.
Now, he knows his heart, their heart, for one. And he even talks about the denominational world in one of my understanding where he says that he sent things to believe because they wanted to be deceived.
Right.
So he knew their heart, and at this point they wanted to come back and want to be where they're at. I look at it as the denominational world.
Okay, I think you're looking at 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 9 and 10, if memory serves me okay. You can start with verse 9 and go down through verse 11. Even he whose coming is in accordance with the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceit of unrighteousness for them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth. Now these people were apparently able to receive the truth, but they chose not to. And then it goes on to say, there at the latter part of verse 10, that they might be saved. I mean, they could have done that, but the choice was no. And for this cause, God sends them a working of error, that they should believe a lie. And then 12, that they might be judged who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. There are people, God says, who would prefer to believe a religious lie. When we look at our world, the religious world around us, there are a lot of religious lies to believe. And that's why Jesus was able to say one time that the way is narrow. And few people choose that way. The broad way has all the other options, and many, many people choose that. So these people could also be fit into that category as well. Anybody else before another quick point? Okay. The other thing that I wanted to point out is when the time comes for the Lord to return, there may not be a huge opportunity for people to have any kind of discussion with Christ at the end of time. But you do as you look at Matthew 7, now here in Matthew 25, do you get the impression that people are going to try to negotiate with God or try to make some kind of final plea? I mean, people today do that, do they not? If you see somebody, and it's in the movies, but in real life as well, a bank is held up, and you have someone come in, they put a gun to an employee's head, generally the employee isn't just sitting there laughing and saying, well, go ahead and pull the trigger. It's a good day to die. What are they doing? They're pleading, they're begging for the life. Don't shoot me, don't hurt me. Don't injure my family. Well, here you don't have something that's like that. Here these people are threatened with what? There's the all-powerful God. Where's he going to send them? Hell. If you're on that list, don't you think that you're going to try to do everything that you possibly can? God, look at my works. God, I had faith. Now, it may not have been, you know, this one that you prescribed, but I had faith. I believed. I did all these many mighty works. Yet as you look at Matthew 7, Matthew 25, the passage that we examined in 2 Thessalonians 2, what's the picture? How many second chances? How many more opportunities?
None.
That's it. Negotiation is not going to take place when folks stand before God. So that's why in Matthew 24, the final verses, we're also going to see it in Matthew 24, the final verses there. We'll also see it in Matthew 25. Jesus says, be ready. If you're not ready when he returns, then you're going to pay a very, very high price, and it's going to be an eternal price. Before we pick up with verses 14 and 15, again, anything that you want to add or ask? Okay. In verse 14, he says, for it, that is, he's continuing to talk about his next and final coming, for it is when a man, going into another country, called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods, and unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his several ability, and he went on his journey. If you'll think back to what we talked about, and again, you have to see the connection between Matthew 24, the end of it, and Matthew chapter 25. Jesus says, the end of Matthew 24, I'm coming back. Based on that, we have then the teaching, some refer to it as a parable, of the 10 virgins. What's the purpose of that teaching? Jesus says, watch, be prepared, because some are not going to be prepared. Then, continuing the same line of thought, he now turns to this teaching about the talents. Three fellows, they're given some money. And here the teaching is not so much watch. He's already covered that. Now the idea is you need to be... Alright, you need to be active. You need to be working. We might say in the previous teaching about the ten virgins, you need to be vigilant. Now you need to be vigilant. Vigilant, diligent. Some of the things he talks about as far as giving this teaching, talent. And as you look at this, you may be reminded of some information back in Luke 19. And let's just go back there and look at that so we can kind of have in our heads that these two things are similar, but they're also very, very distinct. He says, we'll start with verse 11 because this is where the paragraph begins. And as they heard these things, he added and spake a parable. This is specifically called a parable because he was close to Jerusalem, because they supposed that the kingdom of God was immediately to appear. He said, therefore, a certain nobleman, now nobleman is not the word that we have back here in Matthew 25. He goes into a far country, that's about what we have in Matthew 25, to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called how many servants? 10. But how many fellows are we reading about over here in Matthew 25? Well, actually, two are faithful, and then we have this third one who's not. So when you look at the number of people involved, you could also look at when the two teachings were given, you find out that they're not the same. But there are some similarities, and we will make a reference or two back there in just a second. But these 10 servants, they get 10 pounds, Luke 19, verse 11. And here, the teachings, we're not dealing with pounds, we're dealing with talents. In this teaching, Jesus says a man goes into another country. Now, for us, we don't think about that too often. We hear today about various people, and it may not be, you know, the Donald Trumps of the world. We just hear about different people going to, maybe even for vacation. They'll go into a different country, whether that's in the Caribbean, or maybe they're going to go to Australia halfway around the world. Was that how it was in this day and time, though? How many people do you think went outside the country, go to another country? Not very many. I mean, for the most part, you might go 15 or 20 miles outside your local village. If that far, you were born in this spot, and very likely you died in that spot. You just were not a world traveler. So when the Lord says there's this fella, and he goes into another country, what's that tell you about this guy, as far as his means, his resources, his wealth? He's probably got a whole lot of money to be able to travel in this day and time. And then we'll talk about this point a little later as well. But how long's he gone for? Can you spot it? Verse 19. Gone for a long time. Now that's interesting. Even today, if somebody's going to be gone for a long time in another country, now maybe the dollar ratio to that country is pretty good, so you could $100,000, you could live in another country for maybe a couple hundred years. But then there's some other countries, and usually it's either pretty close or it's going to be higher than the country you leave. But this fella was definitely a man of means because of the points that we just pointed out. Now, as you think about this man, this really rich guy, do you think this is just some abstract teaching, or do you think the Lord has something specific in mind? Who do you think? Well, let me rephrase the question. Do you think this man might represent someone? This real rich guy. All right. I believe that's right, because Matthew 24, how do we end? Jesus is coming back. But till he comes back, where is he? He's gone away. Where? He's in another country, if you will. He's in heaven waiting to come back. He is going to come back, Matthew 25, parable of the 10 virgins, or the teaching of the 10 virgins. And at that time, some are going to be prepared for him and some are not. Do you remember back in Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14? We don't talk about it too often, but there, the Son of Man is pictured as returning to heaven. He goes before the Father. He receives a kingdom and so forth. And this seems to be also part of the background here. Before the Lord left the earth, as he gives this teaching, he says he gave, whether we look at this as the rich guy or Jesus, he gave who what? He gave his servants some talents, some goods. In this case, we're simply talking about something that has great wealth. A talent was really more of a weight than a currency. You will find some people that refer to it as money, and it certainly was something that was valuable. As you go back and you look at a talent, I think a good estimate here is probably that they weighed about 75 pounds each. Officially, I guess they would have ranged from about 56 to 80 pounds. And like today, somebody says, well, I have a pound of something. Well, it could be a pound of sugar, it could be a pound of copper, it could be a pound of gold. And such was also true for talents. Talents were often based on silver, copper, or gold. So depending, if you're dealing with metal, depending what the metal was, it was going to be a fairly significant thing, especially if it was going to be something like gold. One source suggested that a single talent was worth 6,000 denarii. And of course, one denarius was what a workman received per day. If you thus kind of go back and you see what we're talking about here is the amount of wealth, even if we're dealing with something like silver, an item that typically has been worth far less than gold, we're talking just one would be about 20 years' wages. One talent, 20 years' wages. So if you want an easy way to put this into today's terms, I mean, the guy that gets, five talents, 100 years' wages. Now, that's a pretty fair sum for most people. Even the guy that got the one talent, if we put that in terms of 20 years, you know, one talent doesn't sound like a lot when we look at it in the text, perhaps, but knowing about how much money this is, it sounds like a terrific amount of money. And this, I think, also explains. I mean, if you 100 plus years of money that you just entrust some people with, it's another reminder that this guy was very, very wealthy. If we're dealing with gold talents, and we don't know what Jesus had in mind, then you could multiply the value by about 30. And that really makes it skyrocket. So once again, just even if just the five talents have been involved, this is really an enormous sum. Verse 15 tells us that the first fellow, he received how many talents? Five. Second guy receives? No. Okay, that's what I said. We don't want to confuse this with Luke's account. Second guy, you're right, receives two. And then the third fellow, he receives one. And now with these talents distributed, this rich guy, what's he do? He heads off on a trip, doesn't he? He goes to the out-of-state country. Can you see how that relates to Jesus? He came, gave us various things, and certainly people have possessed items before the Lord came, and now he returns, and as he is in heaven, what's supposed to be true of us? All right, we're supposed to be watching and working. Now, Jesus, as you look at this teaching, he does not... And let's pick up a cross-reference here. Luke 19:13. Somebody want to head over there for just a second? This is the parallel about the nobleman. All right, Lois. Luke 19, verse 13. Jesus does not, in this teaching, specifically say that these fellows were told to trade. But if you have somebody come along and just hands you 20 years' wages, common sense would say what? Go out and buy a fleet of cars and boats? Common sense says... Yeah. He's probably going to be looking for this money. So we likely need to make a good investment. We likely need to trade, to try to make some gains, to put this to use in various ways. But in Luke's account, Luke 19:13, Lois, let's see what we have here.
And he called 10 of his slaves and gave them 10 minas and said to them, do business with this until I come back.
Okay. Now remember, we're still dealing with the teaching as far as Jesus going away and coming back. But here, he actually comes out and says, with this material wealth that you have, you trade, you do business, you try to increase what you possess. And that seems to me to be an implied lesson that we have here in Matthew 25, though it's not specifically stated. The first fellow, he trades, and how much does he make? He doubles it. He gets five more. Second fellow, he also trades, and what does he make? All right, he is also able to double what he has. Now, Jesus talks about these two fellows and their ability to trade successfully. This is looking ahead a little bit. In verses 21 and 23, he uses several key words there. He says, this person is good. He also says, this person is faithful. Also in 21 and 23, he says, this kind of individual will, at the right time, God will say to them, well done. The people who choose to live in this way, also, verses 21 and 23, they're going to experience joy. And then Jesus says, if you have taken your resources and you have used them well, what else do we find in 21 and 23? He says, one day you're going to be made a ruler. And a ruler over how much?
Many.
Many things, because you demonstrated faithfulness. And then, if people are not willing to make that choice, let's look ahead a little bit, verse 25. Rather than be willing to use what we have and try to make those talents work for God, some people choose to be, all right, lazy. In some cases, they're lazy because of fear. In other cases, they're lazy just because they do not want to work. And for the person who makes this latter kind of choice, what's verse 26 say about them? All right, they're wicked. They're slothful. They're not willing to truly kind of work. And then as you look ahead a little bit at verse 27, you have the word ought. You ought to have put my money to the bankers. And then the Lord says in verse 30, this kind of person is going to be cast out. Verse 28 says they're going to lose what they received. And then the worst part is verse 30. Jesus says the person who is not faithful, that individual is going to experience severe punishment. This is, out of all the teachings in the New Testament, one of the ones that really stands out in my mind is stewardship. And when we talk about stewardship, I'm just not talking about material things. They're part of it. And this parable indicates that. But God has made us stewards. When you look at the early chapters of Genesis, what do you find? God essentially says to man, this planet, it exists. And what's your job? You have rule, you care for it. You have rule and dominion over it. When we think about the things that we're stewards of, obviously the earth is one thing, but what else? All right, a steward is a caretaker. A steward is someone who is in charge of making sure that what they possess is cared for, attended to in a good way. Children. There's some people, when it comes to children, they are not good stewards. They just let kids do whatever they want. They fail when it comes to spiritual training. Do you think, based on the teaching here, people are going to give account for that? Yeah. Especially if you're responsible for sending... Now, again, I want to preface that by saying that children have free will. And parents can do everything, or seemingly everything, just right, and kids don't always turn out well. But for the people who fail to try to properly train their children in spiritual things, and that child at least partially goes to hell because that parent refused to do what they were supposed to do in spiritual things. When it's time to make a reckoning for that stewardship, it's not going to be a pleasant experience. Now, there is forgiveness for that. We all have failings, but for the people who fail in that area and do not repent, it's going to be a big deal. What else? Stewardship over. All right. A lot of people don't think about that, but, time, we can't go back and reclaim it, and we don't always use it in the best way. That's true for every single person. But we are stewards of our time. Don?
Another one is, Brett, I look at it from a different angle.
Okay.
I look at it from the spiritual side. All three of these basically accepted Christ. And one had more leadership talents, whatever, he worked harder, or used his talents in the further of the kingdom. One with the two talents worked just probably as hard. Didn't have quite the talents, but he worked just as hard. The other one didn't do anything after he accepted Christ. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what this says. I don't think it talks about wealth. I don't think it talks about physical stuff at all. I think it's all about, who he will turn away to chastise.
Well, you have both points here, do you not? When you talk about, using your talents, there are some people who have five talents. Five talents in what sense? What are those going to be? Maybe that's a talent to talk. Maybe that's a talent to bake. Maybe that's a talent in the area of wealth that they've been entrusted with. Some people have more time than other people have for various reasons. So you have all these things that factor in there. So I believe that is the other aspect of that, Don. That you have these resources in life, whatever they may be. Some people have many. Some people have few. When you look at what we possess compared to somebody that's over in some African village where they struggle to get water, the things that they possess and have access to are going to be much more restricted or limited than what we have. But whatever those things are, that point that you brought out, they need to use those, they need to be effective, rather than just saying we're going to bury our talent in the sand or our head in the sand and not going to pay too much attention to what we have, perhaps because in our mind it's not that big. No, we'll finish your thought.
But I think we're under risk of saying that, if you relate this to physical acquisition of things, say if somebody, if Christ were to give, he gave him 5,000, think those five talents were basically their talents, their spiritual talents, their talents that they did not possess physically.
Okay.
How to use those talents. Because if you say, well, you take and you multiply your stewards of money, and you multiply the money and multiply the money, more than somebody that tries just as hard but doesn't multiply the money, then are they going to be judged differently in heaven?
Yeah, we don't want to go too far as, you know, putting this in the money category. And that's why I was looking for some illustrations to broaden this. Whatever we have that can be a resource for God, whether it is a material resource, whether it's our hands, some people are mechanically inclined, some people are inclined in some other ways with some mental abilities, where people live. For example, when I think about missionaries, and this is one of the things that I think a lot of preachers struggle with. When you think about sending missionaries out into the world, where do you think missionaries are going to come from? America. America. United States. Our country, right? Shouldn't we be the mission center of the world? Well, wait a minute. Doesn't France have an obligation to send out missionaries? Doesn't Africa have an obligation to send? Sure they do. But the little African village over here probably take them 10 or 20 years to come up with half the fare for a plane ticket. Then they couldn't send the guy with any cash to probably do anything. So they look at their opportunities, and they may just go, 50 miles down the street, because that's going to be the best that they can do in missions. So whatever it is, those abilities. There are some people, you think about Barnabas, he was an encourager. Did he have an obligation to use that talent? He did. The Bible tells us that he was willing to do it. You have, for example, what about an older woman? Just does really well with children. Maybe a very wise woman. Well, nobody wants somebody to be the helicopter parent, and I don't think anybody wants a helicopter helper. But what about that woman? Able to go ahead and at times give some wise advice, some sage words of advice to younger women. You think she's got a talent? Sure. Does she have an obligation to use it? Sure. So I would put that in the broadest sense, Don, whatever the talents are.
Well, I agree from that standpoint.
Okay. No, and that's why I was calling for illustration. So, yeah, we're looking at the broadest possible umbrella here. Physical, material, whatever it is. Use it well, because we're stewards. All right, I think here and then.
I think the answer to his question too is that everything we own is not ours. It's God owned. Everything he's given to us, the talents that he's given to us, it's God's that we return back to him. So he goes through all the talents here, and he uses, like you say, the illustration of money in this particular case, but that isn't what he's talking about. Everything
right.
that we have is supposed to be used to spiritual, an aspect to be concerned for those that are lost and our own Christian brother, so that they don't get lost. I think when you get to the point where we think we own things and it's ours, that's where we have problems, not
yeah.
using our talents. And when it goes down to those that double their talents, they were motivated, they did something. Where the person, even though he didn't have a lot of talent, he still just refused to use what he did have. It might have been a basic, simple thing, but he refused to do anything. He was lazy. And so then he tells him, well, you're a wicked servant. Like you were talking about, it's not about what we own, what we have. It's how we use what God's given us, whether it be money, whether it be time, whether it be showing love to the elderly, showing visiting the orphans, being concerned about our neighbor. You know, all these things are part of our talents.
Yeah. And there are, as you mentioned, there are just literally dozens, if not hundreds, of examples of that. You know, we had Pat Powers, he needed help with the move. Some people showed up with vehicles. May not have been. I mean, there was nobody that had a vehicle that was large enough to haul everything he had. But when we put those things together, we were able to move it. We've had situations here. I've seen situations elsewhere in a congregation where there was someone who was struggling financially. Maybe it was wintertime, maybe it was summertime, the air conditioning unit that they had, the furnace that they had, wasn't working. It went out. They needed heat. They needed something cool as far as that conditioner fixed. And they went out maybe after a hard day at work, maybe when there was snow on the ground, maybe when it was so hot they really didn't want to be outside and work on the unit. And they used that talent, in this case knowledge, and very likely some tools that they had, to fix that air conditioner, to put in a new window that needed to be put in. So the umbrella here is very, very large. And it goes back to what was just said. You can say, well, I've got that talent, and if my window breaks, if my air conditioner breaks, if my furnace breaks, I'm in good shape. What about Joe? What about Sue? So, and I can say this is a very, very important teaching. It also, to me, would go back to Matthew 6, verse 20. Remember Jesus, we talked about this passage a couple weeks ago. He said, lay not up treasures on the earth. But you lay up treasures where? Heaven. How are you going to do that? You're going to do that by being faithful. By doing the kinds of things that God has described in his word. All right, Dolores, back to you.
I just kind of found it comforting in reading this that just like the Lord does with us, this master didn't just wake up one morning and go, here you go, I'm gone. He knew his servants.
Yeah.
And he knew, when it says, you know, dealt it out to them according to their abilities, that's what God does too. He knows that, you know, like you said, everybody has different talents or everybody has a different income or no income or what have you, but even the man with the one talent, he didn't give him the five because he knew he couldn't handle it.
Right.
So he was supposed to do with that one what he could, but it wasn't like he expected him to do more than he was capable of doing.
Think about the widow. Mm-hmm. She gave the two mites, and what did the Lord say? And she did what she could. So here was a woman who was faithful, really, to the maximum. And that's what he requires of us. And that, you know, when you think about God as far as his justice and fairness, you know, compare a fella, you know, who's six, to an Olympic runner. You want to be out there on the track with him if you're the six-year-old? I don't. What about the championship wrestler, you know, that's after, a puny freshman? Well, I don't want to be out there on the mat with him either. So God says, I'm not going to compare you, in this case, to the person who has 10 times your talents. It's going to be, and that's what Paul says, 2 Corinthians 5:10, that each one may be judged according to things in the body, according to what he's done, not according to what others. So it is a very, very comforting passage. Another quick point that I have, unless there's something that you want to add or ask. All right. One source made this point, which I think is also worth mentioning. He said, people with limited talents are most apt to do nothing. I think that's a good point. There are people in the church who will kind of look at themselves, and I don't think that they look at themselves accurately, but they'll say, well, I can't do very much. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not true. But oftentimes, if a person makes that statement, what's the logical consequence that follows? Oh, I can't do very much. I'm going to be off to the sidelines. I'm not going to do anything. Well, that's not an excuse. You may not be able to do much, but it goes back to what Dolores said just a few minutes ago. It is proportionate. You need to do what you can. And age and health, a lot of different factors. It's true for congregations as well. You know, when you look at our congregation, we're around 70 people. If you stacked up the stuff that we do against a congregation of 750 or 1,000, how are we going to look? We're going to look pretty pathetic. I mean, the congregation of 1,000 people, look at all the works that we have. Well, but again, it's proportionate. You have your resources, you have your abilities. Are you faithful with what you have? And that is the key point. Harvey?
I've heard it say that God doesn't really require more than what you are capable of.
Yeah.
I think that goes a long way.
Yeah. And
the more you have, the better capable you are, so you need to step up.
Right. Look at your resources, look at your talents, use them. And then, if you've used them in the right way, know that you're pleasing to him. Okay, let's pick up then with verses 16 through 18, still staying with Matthew 25. He says in 16, straightaway or immediately, he that received the five talents went and traded with them, and made other five talents. In like manner also, he that received the two gained other two. But he that received the one went away and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. If you were looking at these verses on your own, what word should or hopefully would stand out to you? You don't have to read very far. Yeah, I think immediately. What are we talking about? We have resources, we have talents, and we have abilities. Some people will say, well, you know, we've got these things and we'll get to it someday. But here, the master goes away and the people use their resources immediately. They didn't wait. Do you think there's a lesson there for us? There are a lot of good-hearted people today who say, I'm going to get busy for God when? I just need time. And oftentimes, how do they look at that time? It's going to be when my kids graduate from school. Think anybody makes that point? I'm going to get busy for God when we finally can move from the apartment to the house. If you are on the Christian Woman blog, tomorrow's post is going to involve, I think, an interesting post. Lady described a situation. I believe this lady's probably in her 80s right now, had been a preacher's wife for a while. I think she's currently widowed. But she described somebody who wanted to offer some fellowship. They were kind of in between places, and the people that invited this lady and her husband over were residing in an apartment. Now, this lady had a thought which probably would have gone through my mind as well. If you're, you know, in a little, a small motel room, I think it was a motel room, I don't even think it was an apartment. If you're in a motel room, how are you going to provide hospitality to people? I mean, that's, if you're in a motel room, I'm thinking that you're going to be the recipient of the hospitality instead of the giver. But if you see that post tomorrow, she will talk about how they had a little, something like you'd find in a college dorm room, and they'd cooked up some Southern delicacies that I probably would have passed on. But, and some greens and some other things, and it was really a nice event. Well, here was a situation, and you know, they had laundry there and some other things, and it was not the most ideal set of surroundings, perhaps, but still, she did what she could. She had that opportunity, and she used it. People would say, well, when my circumstances get better. I can remember another situation. We had Teresa and I. We were in Montana for a while, and we were poor. People today talk about being poor when they have their cell phone and you know, cable TV and some other things. We didn't have the money for TV, and we were so poor. You know, most months I was balancing a checking account, and we just had a few pennies in the account. Things were that tight for us. And we had the associate preacher take us out for ice cream one night, and I think the bill probably was about $2.50. We wanted to reciprocate, and we didn't have the $2.50 to do that. But, you know, there were some situations where we could still have people in the house. We could offer a night's stay to people, and there were some other things that we could do, even though our resources were very, very limited. And that's something I think that we need to look at. And we don't have to wait for those better circumstances. The kids leave home, or we get to the retirement time of life, or all these other things. Straight away, immediately, we need to start looking for ways that we can go ahead and help. You see this fellow, the Bible says he traded with his 5 talents. He made 5 more. We mentioned the second fellow. He also took his 2 talents. He traded with them as well. And the third guy, just to kind of remind us of what he did, he took his talent, he buried it, goes out, digs a hole in the earth, and puts his money there. Now, there were a lot of ways to gain wealth in the first century. People were able to buy and sell cattle. People sometimes traded in purple. There were oriental spices that people could buy, sell, and trade. A lot of different things that people could do. And especially if you had the kind of wealth that we talked about, 20 years' wages, that would give you a pretty good amount of cash. So Jesus, as he comes to this teaching, he says, you've got a lot to work with. This is especially true in our day and time. But if we, and remember Jesus' teaching, one time he said, to whomsoever much is given, of him shall much be required. Do you think we've been given much? As we look at our country and we look at world history, I mean, we've been given a ton of stuff. You know, we don't have to be, you know, the Donald Trumps of the world to say, oh, well, we don't have very much. Because we're not in this category. We do have a lot, and we do need to be faithful. Anything that you want to add around?